friend feels good about this. Am I and my friend are close. I think I'll, you know, consult this lawyer also. So it's on many levels. Some levels very deep, some levels intermediate, and some levels, you know, rather, let me say, fundamental. But the important thing is finding a lawyer, finding a doctor, or finding a guru. Important thing is seeing that the mentor is proper and for the student to be proper, in that sense. And without such a connection, there's no advancement in terms of transcendence. So you don't need a guru necessarily to go to the heavenly kingdoms. You don't need a guru necessarily to have impersonal liberation. You don't need a guru necessarily to have siddhic powers. But to enter into the spiritual kingdom and to associate with Krishna in his ultimate pastimes, you must have a guru. It's like in the material world. There are some secret societies in politics, in business, etc., where you don't join. You can't just ask for membership. You can't just join. You only can become a part of that if a member, someone who's already a part of that, invites you based on feeling that your character will add to the atmosphere. Nobody actually campaigns to go back to the spiritual world. Nobody actually can go back to Krishna on their own. But we go back because special ambassadors who are connected with the spiritual world create the arrangements to bring us. There's another reason that shows that we're the opposite of a cult. Our leading acharyas, from Prabhupada to Bhaktisiddhanta to Bhaktivinoda to Gorgashodas Babaji to Rupa Goswamiji, all of them are intimate residents of the spiritual kingdom. And because of that, therefore, they give something beyond religiosity. And therefore, it's quite different from general religiosity, whether it's Christianity, Islam, Hinduism, Buddhism. Because they are coming in as special envoys to go throughout the universes to stimulate living entities for general religiosity by giving mercy and benediction, but particularly looking to see where they can plant seeds and where there are some souls who may have the quality to be able to go directly back to the spiritual kingdom. And it's why we must be very careful not to be sectarian, because what most prophets do is what they're supposed to do. What those agents who are directly from the spiritual kingdom do is what they're supposed to do. And that is rare. These prophets go everywhere. Lower planets, medium planets, they go to the heavenly kingdoms, and they even snatch souls out of the Munshi Brahma Jyoti. So as people follow other genuine prophets, they will go to where that prophet is connected with. But these residents from the spiritual kingdom, they go to all of these places, and they are like bounty hunters to pick some souls from here, pick some souls from there, pick some souls from this. A true follower of Christianity goes to heaven. A true follower of Islam goes to paradise. A true follower of Ashtanga Yoga can experience certain cities, etc. They follow it genuinely. Because these are all bona fide systems with bona fide teachers, bona fide scriptures, bona fide prophets. They will get the benefit or go based on what the ultimate goal of that is. As we're just discussing, ultimate love is about relationship, about association, about reciprocation, and about appreciation based on the reciprocations. And to have that level of reciprocation with the actual Godhead, then that is only made available through the agents who are part of that involvement, who then recruit. That means ultimately nobody goes back to Krishna except unless they're recruited by a Gopal or a Gopi. That is the intensity of Krishna consciousness. we look at all of these great souls who come in disguise in our Parampara line, that they're actually eternal associates, lovers, playmates of God. And therefore they create an avenue, an arrangement, bring some souls out many different universes. That's why this movement of Lord Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, it appears every so often in different universes. It is something quite unusual. Any other questions?
Mm-hmm. Do you believe when you enter other realms, like say another dimension, that the validity of numerics is destroyed, if you will?
The validity of what? Of marriage?
Of man's mathematical discoveries. Do you think that that's a solid fact in truth?
1 and 3 equal 4. And that is true.
Yes,
for
is.
Elementary arithmetic, But then if we look at calculus, we look at advanced calculus, then we also have other calculations that are true based on that particular level. So similarly, there are truths, relative truths, based on the particular environment, time, place, situation, and they are also absolute truths. So, as we move into higher realms, then we're dealing with truths that are also more evolved. Just as when we are in academia, we're dealing with certain axioms, principles, etc. But as we advance more in academia, we're dealing with also more advanced tenets. So it's similar in that sense. Not that something that is true on a lower level may not also show its appearance on a higher level, but it will be many more variables associated with that truth. It's like on some of the higher planets, there's even so many more Bhagavatams than what we have here. There's so much more descriptions of certain things. It doesn't mean that what we're having here is not also true, but there is always more. And then if we take all of our books, it's not that all is included there. Because the scriptures are really just catalysts to help us in dealing with our rascal mind. In other words, because the mind is so devious, and the mind is so much of interference. Mm-hmm. And there's a need for so much to be able to tame the wild mind, because the soul knows everything anyway. Means all knowledge is already with the soul, it's just that it's covered over. So the whole process of self-realization is really just how to become natural, once again. The process of learning how to avoid interfering with God's love that's made available for us. How to avoid cheating ourselves. Because in one sense, that's all spiritual life is. How to avoid cheating ourselves from being able to receive God's love in full. Lord is extending the love. We're experiencing some type of amnesia, some type of craziness. Based on how eager we are to be freed of that craziness, the Lord sends us various types of helpers and guides to assist us in such ways. See, it's not that Krishna consciousness has this system of checks and balance only. Like we say, okay, we can variegate, we can validate something by Shastra, proof of Shastra, proof of bona fide sadhu, and proof of bona fide guru. But every system, bona fide system, can be evaluated also by whether something is right or not for that system. Something is right or not for that system, we must check the authorized scripture connected with that. We must check the authorized practitioner of that system and the original teacher or prophet or messenger of that system. When all three things agree, then we know that that practitioner is healthy in his or her system. We don't necessarily judge a system, one system, based on something from the other system. We have to judge each system based on the authorized sadhu, shastra, and guru of that system. We don't judge Buddhism based on the scriptures of Christianity. No. We don't judge Christianity based on the principles of Islam. Somebody is a proper Christian, then they must be following the scriptures, the bona fide scriptures connected with that, the bona fide present day guides or prophets or teachers, and they must be in line with the original acharya or principal or teacher of the system. Somebody's going to be a proper Muslim, then they must be going according to the Quran or in Hadith or in Muslim Mawata, especially Quran. And they must be aligned with bona fide present imams who are representing that system. And they must be aligned with the basic major prophet of the system of Muhammad. And when all of these things are there, then we understand that that is proper. And when not, there should be paranoia. Someone is adhering to the Vedic system, then the same thing is there. Yes. Yeah, the more that there is genuine sense of community, selflessness, loving one's neighbors, oneself, the more this will accentuate God consciousness in general. So the more it will raise consciousness on the planet.
As heaven can be on the earth.
Yes, exactly. As we look at the higher ages, when there was more sense of piousness, this is one of the reasons. People were more into community, more into sense of accountability to others, to nature, and of course to God. Mm-hmm. Sure. Just before you start, maybe while we're talking, come again. Maybe they can serve up prasadam. Okay. Are we taking questions?
Uh-huh. Yes. My question is. My question is, you were speaking before about how people are becoming less of an individual and more of a whole unit, losing our individuality. I've
yes.
always thought that the best way to know yourself is to be able to compare yourself to things around you, be it people, nature, different kinds of like spirituality. You think the world's going to lose that ability to be able to compare itself and learn from that if we become too much like one another and lose our individuality?
Yeah, it's already sort of happening. It's one of the dangers or one of the downsides of this information age. The information age making things so available, and it started with the scientific age, and has made things so available that what happens in one part of the world in just minutes can be made available people to know about it in another part of the world. Now there's certain TV programs that come on, and literally millions and millions of people are watching the same thing, being influenced by the same thing. There are so many fads that are taking place that millions of people begin to accept certain types of things, etc. So because of that, it does cause, amazingly, for people to think they're using their free will, but they're being more imposed upon. And therefore, whoever is controlling the major means of communication becomes very powerful. That's why the media is like very, very powerful, because it influences millions of people. Mm-hmm.
So what you're saying is basically, because due to our loss of individuality, mm-hmm. we're all becoming more of like just this one kind of like a mass society. We still need something to follow. You know, we still need leadership on some level. Like, it seems that we seek it through technology, not through like our own spirituality. Like, we send spaceships up into space, and we just want to know everything about the universe. And all the people that I've read about that have studied things in the universe, so there was so much knowledge and such vastness that you could never as a man, woman, or a person ever conceive or understand it. Mm-hmm. So it's kind of like people are following the knowledge that they're never going to learn. Mm-hmm.
There's a lot always to learn. I mean, life is a learning experience. And there's so many things to experience also. But the important thing is the consciousness of the experiencer.
I think that's what people are losing.
Yes, exactly.
Because everyone doesn't have individual experience. Everyone can watch the same television mm-hmm. program or read the same newspaper. Mm-hmm. It's not two people. Not one man talking to his son, telling him a story about something, and the son feel a certain way. He might tell it to someone else's child, a different way. There's no. It's not very personal. It's a very impersonal world now.
Yes, it's a very good analysis. We're losing community for commodities.
Definitely.
We're beginning to substitute real relationships for just, you know, things.
Well, they've always said that money was the root of all evil. Mm. I think it really is.
With, yes, improper consciousness.
I have many questions, but I'm going to ask one.
Sure.
From something I heard on TV in reference to what you were saying about cults. They said something about Moody's, Hare Krishna, how do you defend yourself? Like, is there another person like yourself or race? Do you ever feel you have to get on a program and tell them, like these groups here, you know, what the message that you're trying to spread?
Sure. Whenever we do any major media programs, we explain what the philosophy is. But see, for many people today, they don't care. Their concern is that if you don't talk like they talk, if you don't worship as they worship, if you have some different ideas, then it's weird. And it's a cult. Let's see. And so some people, whatever you say, they've already categorized you because you're doing something different. And so such people won't change. But the others will think differently once they have a chance to be educated and informed. And that's
someone says you're doing something wrong, you know you're not. There's absolutely no reason to say, no, I'm not, because you know yourself that you're doing the right thing.
Actions are always the strongest defense. But in communication, sometimes people are just unaware. And so they can be informed and they can understand.
Before I ask my question, I want to say that I appreciate the book that you, all of you wrote, in particular two, and that's Leadership in the Age of Higher Consciousness. I'm still reading that. it seems like you can open up to any page and find something of value. And of course, the biggest. I appreciate that it's a book for almost anybody. And the question I have is the love and the unity in the group. What are some areas on keeping or protecting that love and unity? The various members of a group, what are some of the things they can do or be concerned with where they don't lose their sincerity, where someone doesn't come in and, you know, create disturbance, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah, this is very important. Because this is, we're talking about, you know, community in general. Community is so much based on communion and communications. And communications means that people are sharing and revealing and being genuinely concerned about the interactions. In not a, you know, manipulative way, but in a genuine, serious mood, a serious spirit. And communion means that there are serious things that they're sharing, mutually sharing. So, the materialistic society is very geared toward individualism, egocentricity, self-centeredness. Spiritual society is so much geared toward how to serve each other, be concerned about the welfare of each other. So much geared toward trying to be one's brothers or sisters keeper in that sense. In order to do that, then we have to be careful about false ego. The false ego comes in, not so much based on what is really the best thing for the community, but false ego is more or less engendering what the individual would like to have happen based on their idea, based on their glorification, based on their distinction, etc. So we must just be careful not to play into the old paradigms of just again functioning based on self-centeredness and selfishness. See, we do that in material life. Sometimes we bring that into the spiritual community also. And that's unhealthy. You should be more revealing in spiritual associations. Always trying to see what would be pleasing to the Lord. What would be pleasing to the Lord's prophets. And we use that as a barometer. Then it helps us so much more about what to say, what to do, and how to interact. But if we just think, what will be pleasing to my senses? What will be pleasing to my mind or my sovereign interest? Then that is not spiritual. But if we're thinking, what will be pleasing to the Lord? Then we can then see a big difference in some of the things that we do, because now we'll be realizing we're doing this as an offering to God. You're going to offer somebody something. You're going to offer something that they will be ready to receive, something that will be pleasing to them. And we know that God is not going to be pleased by some deviations, some nonsense, some artificial, you know, flattery, ingratiating. He's going to be most pleased by our genuine submissions of devotion, our genuine caring, sharing with others. And when there is these kind of disturbances, then we should always defeat them with a higher devotion. So you can get into one ego versus another ego, and it just brings incoherence and chaos. Somebody says something very harsh to you, you can get also back into speaking harshly about them, and it goes on and on. Or somebody says something very harsh to you, you can thank them and try to use it for more growth, rather than getting stagnated, rather than letting them stagnate, you will stagnate the environment. Just do the more compassionate or selfless thing and let that permeate throughout the atmosphere. See, there's some people who just like to try to stop things. They can't stop. They like to interfere. So just by constantly trying to patch up this, patch up that, trying to defend or trying to counterattack, then one can become defeated or slowed down. So better to just live more and more the life of devotion. That will itself kind of extinguish some other things that, that may be unhealthy.
So it's kind of like you have to have a balance in the things you do, like the way you live.
The balance?
If someone yells at you, you shouldn't yell at them back, because like you said, you don't get anywhere. This is, you can prove this very easily.
Yes.
Just go out somewhere and yell at someone and watch them yell back at you, and you get nowhere. You get an argument.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
It's kind of like you have to, you don't have to oppose something, but you have to work with it.
Mm-hmm.
That's what being humble comes
in. Yeah, being humble is a powerful weapon. Doesn't mean being foolish or naive. Being humble means somebody is throwing stuff at you and you're not even going to even allow it to connect. You're not going to lose one night of sleep. You're not going to get imbalanced. You're not going to get distracted. But you're going to care about them that they're wasting their own time. You're going to feel genuinely some sadness that they're bringing down their own sense of humanity. But you're not going to bring your sense down. So it's not ignoring or not being foolish. It's caring but not being distracted.
I need to know it. Is it absolutely necessary to choose one spiritual master, or can you, see, up until now I've been like eclectic and taking like, you know, because it's all God and it's all God. And I've read Mayor Baba that he said that it's necessary to choose a master or
Well, if you do many, many things, no problem with it. But the tendency is that you don't do anything so profoundly. The idea is to do something profoundly to the point that that becomes expansive. Do something profoundly, you have a base, you have a connection. And from that, it would expand. And you're grounded, you're healthy. Otherwise, there's a tendency of being unchaste and not really dedicating oneself to anything, or not accessing deeper connection that then allows us to see the universal connection. Sometimes we're trying to see a universal connection without making a deep connection. And that's things. That's why the great teachers always emphasize about being chaste through whatever tradition or whatever prophet or whatever spiritual master. And as you are sufficiently chaste, then that connection is bona fide, then you naturally will develop a eclectic or universal appreciation, because you will tune in to truth wherever truth may be. But even though you use a certain key for accessing that truth, see, that a certain connection is needed for accessing the truth. And once you make that connection, then you can see other truths also. In that sense. But if you just try to see other truths first, then the tendency is that one will just keep being on the surface and not be able to go deep in anything. Anyone else? I'll come back to you. Let me see anyone else. Anyone else who hasn't asked a question? Yes.
Raise them so much stuff for them. How do we raise them to God?
Yeah, it's very difficult because especially the teenagers, even those a little younger, the greatest influence is the peer pressure. The peer pressure is the actual greatest influence. She sees a proper wife, supposed to do that. The greatest influence is peer pressure. But the peer pressure is influenced by the environment. Okay? So when someone is trying to be righteous, but if all around them so many of their peers are not, it's very difficult. Because they can hear from the teacher and they categorize that in one way. You hear from the mother and the father and they categorize that in one way. But so much of what they are going to really embrace is going to be based on peer pressure. With what mommy and daddy said in the background. So therefore, again, that's why community is important. Spiritual culture is important. And that's why who is it? Clinton's wife has written this book, It Takes a Village to Raise a Child. And this is, you know, it's an ancient African proverb. Because a parent can't just raise a child on their own. You can help, you can give the kids much help as you want. The child is going to be experiencing things from the environment. And so both of those things are going to come into play. Especially to get older, the peer pressure is going to be their greater sense of identity. But if more people are also trying to instruct their children righteously, then even the peer pressure becomes more of a righteous nature. And the children begin to respond more in that sense. See, everyone has their free will. And we can give the kids the most amazing care and the most amazing guidance. Still, they can turn out, you know, to be very obnoxious. Because the environment may be so hostile or degrading. And they're constantly imbibing it. But if we can give them a good foundation, nice care, and then if the environment is not too distracting, then what will happen is that even if they get off, even if they become a little imbalanced, they won't go too far up. They'll keep being reminded about what, you know, mommy or daddy has told them. Anyone else? So please take, I'll just say one prayer for us, and you can all take. Take a few more questions, but please take. We like to do many things at the same time. No problem.
I had a question though.
Okay.
About, you were talking about being chaste and everything.
Mm-hmm.
That's like, it's more or less in a like a figurative sense. Like any kind of like conflict could be some sort of chaste.
Mm-hmm.
It's like everybody goes through, because even if you look at like religious things, like if you look at Jesus Christ, they crucified him. That was sort of a chaste.
Mm-hmm. He was chaste to the mission of his father, Krishna. He had a certain thing to do. When he came in the world, he did that. Being chaste, being righteous, being devotional often is not understood by society, by the masses. And one should not deviate or become weak or become a coward because most people may not accept or agree.
Persecute you to your own benefit, mm-hmm. to enlighten yourself and to gain knowledge from it, then it's not something that persecutes you, it's something that educates you.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Like any kind of hardship can educate you, I guess.
We often learn through conflicts. We often learn through challenges. We often learn the most when we have to, we find ourselves, you know, in desperate situations.
It's kind of like a philosopher said, mm-hmm. Socrates guy. Mm-hmm. Like I'm like taking some of these classes now, in my degree. Mm-hmm. And Socrates said, you know, all the people in the village thought he was the wisest. Mm-hmm. He went to the Delphic Oracle and asked, you know, who's the wisest man? Mm-hmm. And he said, no one is wiser than you. Mm-hmm. The Delphic Oracle, I think Apollo was in there. Mm-hmm. He was their god of wisdom, and he spoke in riddles, and it was up to Socrates to try to figure out what it was the riddle was. So Socrates thought, you know, I can't be the smartest man because I don't know anything, and he actually went around to all the different people, like the craftsmen, the poets, the musicians, and he noticed something, that he knew something that they didn't. So that because they were skilled in one area, they thought they had knowledge in others. Whereas he knew what he didn't know and knew that he did not know. So it's kind of like what you're trying to say is like the more you learn, the more you realize that you have to learn through a hardship. You learn, you know, I'm not that strong. I need to be stronger. You know, I don't know how to do this. I need to learn how to do this.
This is a sign, nice comment. This sign of real knowledge, that the more we begin to know about God, the more we realize there's so much more to know, the more we realize there's so much more to experience, the more we realize how much amazing adventure and sublimeness, you know, is accessible. And when we have a very small amount of knowledge, the tendency is to think that there's nothing else to be known. Tendency is to think that we know everything, and if we don't know it, it has no value.
You didn't get started.
How does that what you just said connect up with the main reason that you wrote the book, The Beggar, and the main message that you have in The Beggar?
Okay. There's two things. Yeah, each of the books I wrote are kind of distinctly of a different areas or different audiences. The beggar is prayers to Guru, prayers to Krishna, as to the Godhead, with the understanding that one, God is there hearing, and we are in a destitute situation, and if we focus that destitution to the Lord, then there will be all types of amazing reciprocation. It's written a little bit like the leadership book, in that the leadership book addresses several secular considerations. When one reads the book, it kind of unconsciously brings in all types of transcendental input, even though it's just addressing certain secular things. And so the beggar, they are prayers to God, but it's written in such a way to help a person to dive deeper in his or her level of consciousness and connecting with deeper sense of spirituality by taking this more kind of contemplative, introspective mood, try having more greed, you know, for the spiritual goal. Greed, you know, for the spiritual goal. So it's packed to, you know, to help to, you know, to increase one's spiritual greed. See, often there's a, you know, there's a need for bridges. So some of the things that's underlining, you know, the leadership book, some of them, if I wrote it just, you know, straightforward, some people may have trouble. We emphasize, you know, these four rules and regulations. Some people have no trouble. Some people would. But because we are addressing so many secular things, that it kind of, you know, are sort of, it's a universal. So it becomes harder to deny some of the points. Because it's also a mature point of view. I mean, like, the foreword is written by a high-level guy at the Pentagon. I have UN people who have, you know, written commentary. So it's touching upon some of the best of the mature world, while at the same time, or the best knowledge getters or power players. Pentagon is one of the most powerful institutions in the world. It's one of the biggest businesses in the world. And so to use such people like this and to involve them in the project is a way to, you know, to reach a larger audience also. This book has already went to several, you see, celebrities here in America, several presidents of different countries. It's even just a couple of days ago, it was launched in Nigeria, with the leaders of Nigeria. Some months back, when I physically, this time I couldn't be there because I was in India, but some months back, the book was launched in the parliament of Sierra Leone. The Chief Justice of the country, Leader of the House of, the Speaker of the House, candidate for Vice President, they were the chief, see, launcher, and the ambassador to Germany. And the Chief Justice of the country recommended that this book would be used as a leadership handbook for all the members of Parliament. And the candidate for Vice President asked that we would give seminars to the leaders based on the prison. So already in such a short time, it's going around. And just a few months ago, I was asked by some of the leaders in Russia if they could have permission to translate it into Russian. So it's being translated now into Russian. Any other questions? Guys back there? Did everyone get the prasadam yet? Still a few more people didn't get.
I'd like to talk more about the previous question about the importance of one master and another.
Mm-hmm. See, it's kind of practical. Just like, for instance, when you have your own doctor, then he's more accountable to you, you're more to him. You can get sick and go to any doctor, there's no problem. But your own physician knows your history. And a lot of stuff you don't have to do with him because he got your record, he knows you, and you have formed a relationship. And also, he's more responsible if something is wrong with you, because he's supposed to know. If some problem comes up, he's more locked in and taking care of you, supposedly, because you have submitted yourself to him to take care of you. And therefore, he is connecting with you and such. So you can go to other doctors and they can give you some help. No question of that. But people feel a lot more comfortable when they have their own broker, their own lawyer, their own doctor, because then they get this ongoing line of communication and reciprocation. So that's the position of, like, having one's own spiritual master.
Master, you follow just one, it'll remove like a void of communication. You know, the lines of communication will be open. Like, they'll know everything about you, you know everything about them. It's not like you're digressing backwards, because kind of like you said about the doctors, if you keep going to different doctors all the time and don't just have one, you have to fill out forms, and just for them to get to know you, so it takes longer for them to treat you.
Sure. It could be problematic, because you can go to different doctors who are bona fide, but they're different systems. So what you do for allopathic treatment is different from some other holistic And sometimes these things, although they can work if you follow it properly, if you start mixing medicines, mixing treatment, then even though one treatment can help, then it doesn't help because you're not concentrating on it, etc.
Makes sense. Exactly.
It's very practical. You know, the last point.
Well, understanding a little bit that I know about karma and understanding that Krishna knows all. The Holocaust happening with the Jews. I don't know how to ask this. Did that have to do with, in any way,
the karma is very, very intricate. There's individual karma, there is race karma, there is planetary karma, there's universal karma, and there's galaxy karma. So yes, everything is happening based on some type of actions and thoughts.
Thank you. that's it, brother.